the 4th of April this year, at the Build Conference in San Francisco, Anders Hallsberg went up on stage during one of the keynotes and announced the next iteration of C#. That's not news. What he announced, though, was a lot more than just a new set of language features. What he announced was the long-awaited Roslyn compiler, which would make a dramatic difference to how we would be able to build tools and extensions for the C# and Visual Basic languages. But the big news was the delivery model. Instead of shipping proprietary code hidden behind the wall of a DLL, they open-sourced Roslyn. They not only open-sourced it, they not only presented you with all the source code to the C# compiler and the tooling that goes with it, they made it a permissive license. This was not a Microsoft shared source, you can look but you better not touch license. They made it available for us to play with and tinker with and do whatever the hell we want with. My name is Ivan Tolson. I used to work for a small Wellington startup called Green Button. We got bought by Microsoft a couple of months ago, and so I now work for Microsoft. The reason I'm telling you this is because you will see Ivan Tolson from Microsoft speaking about C#. I do not represent the C# team. Nothing I'm going to say is official C# team doctrine. It's certainly not official Microsoft doctrine. I'm coming from the background of an interested outsider, a user of the language who's been following these shenanigans for a while. I was a C# MVP for a few years. And I'm sharing what I've learnt and my enthusiasm for the changes with you. But I am not wearing my Microsoft hat while doing so. So do bear that in mind. I don't want to get sued or sacked. All right. For most people, though, the main thing about the future of C#, the main thing that you're going to want to know out of this is what are the new features that are coming into the language? You know, what's actually going to make a difference to me on a day-to-day basis? And so I'm going to spend quite a bit of time on that, and then we'll talk a little bit about the Roslyn infrastructure and the delivery model and stuff like that. So the new features in C# vNext, presumably 6, again, nothing is official, nothing. You'll see how unofficial it all is. Fall into three main categories. Simplifying the writing of classes, so being able to just write classes with a lot less code, a lot less ceremony. Secondly, there's a bunch of convenience features. They're just, you know, handy little things that probably aren't going to change your world, but will make writing a lot of code, again, a little bit simpler, a little bit less verbose, a little bit less ceremony. And finally, there's some tidying features, things that kind of should have been there and they're kind of available elsewhere, but they hadn't quite managed to get slotted into previous versions of the language, so finally catching up with those. So I'll start by diving into the simplification of classes. Now, C# has always been a fairly explicit language. If you want something to happen, you have to spell out that it's going to happen, because we've kind of learnt from other languages that implicit magical stuff that's happening behind the scenes is kind of scary and kind of woo and kind of wow, and you don't really know what's happening, and C++ copy constructors and exceptions in the middle of them and seg faults and formatting your hard disk, and it's all kind of scary. So the C# original philosophy was, let's try to keep this pretty explicit. And then they added link. And then they added dynamic. And then they added async await, which is about as magical as you can possibly get. So that philosophy has kind of gone a little bit by the wayside. But one area where it has kind of stuck with us is in those real fundamentals of how do I define classes. So suppose that I want to create a simple immutable record type in C# 5. You know, here I go. It's a product that somebody can download from my website. And here I go. I need to create some read-only fields for the for its state. I need to write a constructor which takes all those inputs as parameters and copies them into those fields, And then I need to write these wrapper properties to expose those fields. And that's, you know, for basically something which is three bits of data, that's a reasonable amount of code. So the C# team thought, well, how can we simplify this? How can we make this much more concise? And what they come up with is this idea that they call primary constructors. And the idea of a primary constructor is you can kind of fold the class declaration and the constructor signature together into one super compact lump of code, and Higgs bosons come out. And here we go. Where's my product? There we go. So there is our product class in C# 6. And you can see I've got my class declaration or my class name, but I've also got those parameters appearing as adjuncts, as arguments, if you like, to the class, not just to the constructor, but to the class itself. And that's where the name primary constructor comes from. Now, as a consequence of that, I need to actually be able to do something with those things. Now, those properties, unlike, for example, the F# equivalent that Ian showed you in the previous session, if you were here, those things don't hang around for the lifetime of the class. The C# people don't know how you want to use those things. But what you can do is you can assign them to properties. And this is where another new piece of syntax comes in. You can now have get-only auto properties. So in the past, if you wanted an automatic property, you have to have both a get and a set. Now you can just have a get, and you can initialize it during construction. In fact, you can do this as a general thing. So read-write properties will also allow you to initialize them. So again, instead of having to write an explicit constructor where you assign a value to an auto property in the constructor body, you can now just initialize them with a value, same as you would if there was a field. It is planned that you'll be able to do this with initializing read-only auto properties from a constructor. That's not available yet, except for primary constructor arguments. So here I go. I've got my ID property. I initialize it from the ID primary constructor argument. I've got my name property. That's read-only as well. And I initialize that from the name constructor argument. I can also use these things to initialize fields like that. And I can do that if I want to be able to keep them in a private area, in private state for later use in a method, for example. We also have some simplifications to the way that we can write short methods. Again, if we look at the original class, I didn't even write the method because it was so hard, so difficult. Now, if I can get all this on the screen, I can use this lambda-like syntax to write methods without all that ceremony of curly braces and writing return. So that is just equivalent to, that fat arrow is just equivalent to curly braces and return. I can also do that with properties. So there is an expression bodied property. And the way that the compiler knows the difference is obviously that a method has an argument, a property does not. So that gives us a method and a read-only property and allows us to do it again in a much more concise way. To see just the impact of that on the size of a class, here's an example of a couple of simple geometry classes, a point and a vector. And if you imagine how much, you can see how much I've been able to pack into this screen just by those simplifications. I've not had to have the ceremony of read-only fields. I've just got these initialized properties. I've not had to write a constructor. I can auto-initialize that property as a read-only, static read-only property. I can use this concise expression-bodied method notation. And similarly with my vector case. So you can see we're reducing the amount of code significantly. Actually, there's not a lot of magic going on here. It's pretty self-evident, I think, what the expansion of all of those things is. You can see pretty clearly what's going on. Does anybody have any questions about the primary constructors or the simplifications? Yes? Can you add a body to the primary constructor? I'm glad you asked me that. That's an excellent question. Shall we try it? Shall we try it? Yeah. Try it. All right. Good. No, we won't try because I've closed the file. Right, where do we go? There we go. All right, let's take an example. Let's say we want, say, a text element class, which is just going to be essentially a simple wrapper around a piece of text. But what do we not like about strings? We don't like they can be null. Everybody hates nulls. Who hates nulls? Yes, we hate nulls. Right. Who loves nulls? Okay. Wow, that's more popular than I expected. That was at least three people. So, consider that text element class, and I just want to be able to parameterize it with the text. And we have this slightly weird syntax. It's actually exactly like the sort of constructor that you see nowadays, except it hasn't got a name. It's just this weird sort of pair of braces floating in nowhere. And yeah, I don't know if I like that, but that's what we have at the moment, and it does get the job done. So we can do things like validation or calculation, whatever, using those parameters within a constructor body. Any other? Yes? What about overloaded constructors? Another excellent question. So let us say, for example, that I want to have a product which I'm running on examples here. I'm going to have a constructor which defaults the download size to zero because that makes products faster to download. So I can write and have I got that right? Is the wiggly going to go away? Yes, the wiggly has gone away, so that must be correct. And again, just to be clear, when I say correct, I mean it works in this version of the Roslyn compiler. I'm running here Visual Studio 14 CTP3. We haven't lost our knack for snappy names along with the open sourcing. Everything is subject to change. Things have already changed since the first Roslyn drop. They will change again. There is already one design decision one feature I'm going to show you later on, which they've already changed. But yes, so we can create those other constructors. We can overload constructors. We can also use chain derived class constructors. So if I go widget and derive that from product CS6, because it's a particular kind of product, then I can go something like 1, 2, 3, 7, 8, 9. So I can call base class primary constructors with that syntax. Anything more on primary constructors? Okay, they're a nice little feature. Oh, I've got wigglies there. Maybe I did something wrong. I need a bigger font size. It's expecting a space in comma. Okay, I'm not sure what's going on there. That used to be the syntax. They may have changed it. This is what I get for asking myself questions rather than waiting for you to ask me questions. Should have not tried that. All right. Let's just control Z out of there so I can at least compile things. There we go. All right. So let's take a look at some of the convenience features that they're adding. Who likes trigonometry? Somebody? Oh, okay, yeah, we have some trig fans in the front. Okay, that's awesome. Right. I know that one of the things that has been bothering you over the years when you're doing your trigonometry, your awesome trigonometry, is you can't just write something like sine or cosine or whatever. You have to write math.sine or math.cosine. Math.cosine. How many other cosines are there? All right. So, this was boring. So, what we are allowed to do in C# 6 is we are allowed to write using system.math. So we're not now using a namespace, we're able to do a using of a static class. And when we've using a static class, we can trig out as much as we like. None of this math dot nonsense. You can just use those members as if they were in some sort of crazy global namespace. So they were sort of declared locally. So it's the same as any other using. It's bringing names into scope, except it's doing with names from a static class. Don't go too hog wild about this, because obviously it's bringing a lot of names into scope. But if you're doing something that's quite maths intensive or console intensive or whatever, then doing a using static to bring in those namespaces, bring in those static classes, might be a way to make your code a little bit more readable. All right, another thing that has always annoyed me a lot is out parameters. So things like this, you know, try parse or try get value on a dictionary, things like that are actually really handy, because rather than getting exceptions and having to deal with them, you can do this try parse or try get value, check the return value, and the result comes out through an out parameter. The problem is that using out parameters requires quite a bit of ceremony, because if you want to use them, then you need to sort of declare that ahead of time and then pass an out reference to it, to the method. In C# 6, we will have a feature called declaration expressions, which are kind of declaring an expression and populating it kind of in one go, which you can do at the moment for things like local variables or whatever, but you can't do for things like out variables. So in C# 6, you'll be able to write something like that without having to have that external declaration, without having to have that pre-declaration of that weird uninitialized looking thing. In fact, this is smart enough that you don't even need to worry about writing out the type by hand, because if you can see there, it will infer the type if you put a var there. So again, not a huge feature, saves a certain amount of effort. It's particularly useful with link statements. So if you imagine trying to do a try parse or a try get value or whatever within the body of a select method where you can't declare local variables, this gives you a way of declaring that variable and having its value assigned within that lambda expression without having to muck around with doing squirrely brackets and setting up things and writing return and all those dreary things that we used to do in C# 5. You can also use it for, again, those kind of slightly tedious cases where you want to initialize a value from an impure function, a function that has side effects or may not always return the same value, but you want to use that value several times. So in this, for example, random.next returns a different value each time. Now they've fixed that bug. It returns a different value each time. So if I want to square random numbers, I can now just do that rather than having to declare a variable, capture a random number into it, and then square the variable. I can just go, yeah, x equals r.getNext, use it. And life is good. Or at least life is shorter, which is, I guess that's good. Right, and I'm going to have to use the mouse. I've really lost all of my files here. There we go. All right. Ah, yes. My possibly least favorite new feature. Who are people who like nulls? Yeah, okay. You are in for a treat. Yes! All right. So imagine if you have a customer. I know for some of you that may be tricky, but imagine you have a customer. And you want to write a letter to them because, you know, old school. I have a customer, they have a name, they have a first, I want to be personal to them. So firstly, I need to check, is my customer null? Because nulls get everywhere. Apparently due to that guy putting them in all over the place. If I've got a null customer, they might have a null name. So I've got to check for all of these conditions. And so you end up with this sort of cascading series of ifs. Well, not anymore. Who knows the law of Demeter? Awesome. So the law of Demeter is a recommendation that says don't write long chains of dots, because it means you're coupling your class over here to something over here. You should just be kind of wrapping things in a helpful way. The C# 6 introduces a null propagation operator, which basically allows you to violate that law faster and harder than ever before, and yet still produce nulls, which will make some people happy. So what the null propagation operator does is basically the same as what I showed you there. So this customer ?name means if customer is null, then null, otherwise customer.name. Now, of course, we could have a non-null customer with a null name. So if I want to get their first name, I'll want to use another null propagation operator. But basically, it just saves us writing those nested if statements. So with something like that is really scary and unpleasant, and not just because of the Oracle reference, we can replace all of that with a very simple check. Notice, by the way, that because that length property is a integer, but I've got this null propagation thing going on, I can't assume that I'm going to get an integer result out. I might or might not, depending on the null propagation. And therefore, the return type of that is going to be, as you can see, nullable integer rather than integer. So was there a question over there? Or just stretching? Okay. Sorry, just checking. We can do this on other things as well. So, for example, you can call methods through the null propagation operator, and what that will do is, if that is actually given a customer, then it will send them a stroppy email. If it is given a null, then it will do nothing. It will just not call the method, rather than failing with a null reference exception. This is not an excuse to go flinging nulls around. They still scare me, I have to admit. All right, any questions about null propagation? Yes. What happens to the return value of send stroppy email? I've got good news for you. Send stroppy email is void, so I don't have to answer that question. Sorry, that was terribly rude. Let's try that. So my guess would be that this is going to become a nullable int. So let's have a quick hover. And yep, so that's going to become a nullable int. So the return value is still available, but if the method is not called, then there is no return value, which in C# is surfaced as null. Does that make sense? All right. A particularly handy case for that sort of null propagating invoke operator is event handlers. In a classic event handler, if you wanted to be thread safe, then you would have to copy the event delegate into a local variable, check that local variable against null, and if that was non-null, then you would run the delegate. Because the null propagation operator guarantees that it will only evaluate the left-hand side once, in C# 6, you can replace it with that. Because that stroppy email acknowledge, that event is only going to be evaluated once. Essentially, it's copied into a local variable for you, and then that local variable is checked against null. So even if you've got something that has side effects or could be volatile, it's still safe to use the non-propagation operator. All right. Now, one of the difficulties in demoing the current feature set or the planned feature set for C# 6 is they haven't actually quite finished it yet. And this is, I think, part of the interesting part of the open source delivery model, is that it's kind of now all out in the open and they are mucking around with things. They are shipping different versions, they are getting feedback from the community, and things are changing, and they are changing quite a bit. But they're putting out these kind of partial versions to get that feedback. They're not trying to get everything, all their ducks in a row, and say, here it is, here's the CTP, play with it. It's kind of, well, we're building this as we go along. Here's what we've got so far, and here is what we've not got so far. And if you have a look on the Roslyn site, on the documentation page, on the language feature status, then you can see they are tracking what's done, what's planned, what's been withdrawn, what's not planned, what's sort of a maybe, and you can kind of keep an eye on all that. And I'll talk more about that a little bit later on. So what are the planned things that I can't actually show you at the moment? One, again, small thing, but quite handy for those of you who like writing really long constants, is you can now use digit separators in literals. So no more sitting there, peering at the screen going, 1, 2, 3, 4. You can now group them in, possibly, if you like, you can group them in confusion. I mean, it doesn't enforce anything on there. If you want to go like that and upset your coworkers, it's not going to stop you. Don't do that. We are also tentatively gaining binary literals. So in the same way that you can create a hex literal by using OX, you'll be able to go 0B. And this is one where having those separators is a really, really good idea. Another small feature, but again, makes things a little bit more readable, dictionary initializers. We already kind of have those in that you can write this kind of weird syntax because of the way that initializers work. They're basically calling .add and brackets the number, the set of things inside that squirrely bracket thing. So because dictionary's got this add key comma value thing, that works, but it's kind of weird and looks horrible. So they're planning to add something that looks less weird and less horrible, which is using this, using an indexer style notation like that. That was implemented in a previous CTP. It's been dropped from this one for, I don't know why, but because reasons. What else have we got? Event initializers. So I love initializers. I love being able to do that. I think it makes life a lot more readable, but it doesn't work with events. So I kind of have to capture my variable and then use this blasted plus equals syntax and then do something with it. In C# 6, the intent is that I should be able to do that as part of my initializer block and save having to keep those temporary variables around. If anyone has any questions on these as I go by, then don't wait till I ask for questions, just jump in and yell at me if I don't see you. There's a plan to support params. So at the moment you can use params array arguments, like in string.format, where it can take an arbitrary number of arguments because they're declared as params object array. And the compiler will, if you can then call that string.format, some argument, A, B, C, D, however many you want. The compiler will take care of packaging those up into an array and handing it off so to the function so it can be processed. This is quite a nice feature. It allows sort of a var args-like design without the complexity of sort of C++ var args. One limitation is it doesn't play terribly nicely with link. So in C# 6, they're planning to add this params I enumerable, which will look exactly the same as params array, except, did you guess, with I enumerable in instead. And the sole reason for doing that really is so that instead of having to do a toArray in order to pass the results of a link query to that thing, you can just pass the results of the link query directly. I've previously been asked if I called that, if I called that with actual arguments, so print strings, some other string, some third string, would those arguments be lazily evaluated? The answer is no. In C#, arguments are always eagerly evaluated, and in that case, the compiler actually just packages them up into an array because an array implements I enumerable of T. And another feature, this is probably being dropped, but may make it in, we're not sure, is this thing called a semicolon operator. And again, the idea here is to make writing lambdas a little bit simpler, so that if you want to, say, add a bit of logging to your lambda, you could just stick a console.writeline or whatever in front of it. And you wouldn't have to have the ceremony of putting then squirrely braces around it and putting a return statement in there. You'll stick that sequence of statements in there. And the value of the lambda is still the last one, but these other ones get evaluated. So it's kind of like the C comma operator. I don't know why that function is in there. That may be left over from previous version of this talk. I dread to think what happened during that previous version. Oh, sorry? Thank you, Ian. I'm informed that when the customer emails you, or when you email the customer, that is what you do. So do you have customers like that? Ian apparently does. Another really neat one, which is probably not going to get in there, unfortunately, is string interpolation. So in classic C#, we have string.format, which is all very well, works nicely. But again, it's a little bit verbose. So there is a proposal that we should be able to put expressions into our string literals and have them evaluated. And the syntax for this is very much under discussion. There has been a previous version where it was something like a / open squirrely brackets to make it happen. I think the latest thinking is to prefix the string with a dollar to indicate this is an interpolated string rather than a pure literal. Again, what actually happens is that the compiler just expands that into a string.format format. So there's no sort of new deep feature here. It's just a little bit of syntactic sugar to make a quite common scenario nice and easy. And then there is one more little feature, which for those of you who enjoy your refactorings, and this will be quite neat. In the past, if you've been doing something like referring to a method name or a property name, something like that, for example, when you're implementing the dreaded iNotify property changed, where you need to embed the name of a method or property as a literal string, which is fine until you rename that method or property, at which point it all compiles fine and then blows up during the most important demo, because that's when things blow up. What they're introducing in C# 6 is a name of operator. So this is, it's really very silly, because all it does is it returns that name, like quotes, except that because it's actually referencing a symbol, it means that if I do a refactoring, then it should get picked up, but actually, oh, okay, at least I get a compile error. The refactoring tools are not up to it yet, but at least now I'm being warned, well, hang on, you're referring to a method or member that doesn't exist, which I wouldn't get with a literal. All right. And then a few miscellaneous little tidying features. So the big thing in C# 5 was async await, which allowed you to write asynchronous code much, much more easily, with one small limitation. They determined that with the way that they implemented async and await, it was unfortunately impossible to use the await operator within a catch block or a finally block. You could use it inside the try or inside normal code, but not inside catch or finally. There's a slightly apologetic little note in the C# 6 draft spec that says, we figured out how to do it, so it wasn't impossible after all. So they've done it. You can now use your await in catch blocks and finally blocks. There is also a very minor feature. In the past, if you wanted to use, in the past, collection initializers couldn't use extension methods. So when you use a collection initializer, like this, what it does is it just repeatedly calls the add method on the collection object. If you have a badly designed collection that does not have an add method, you might think, ha-ha, I'm too smart for you. I will write an extension method called add, and then I'll be able to use a collection initializer. And the C# compiler said, no. No one knows why. Did they put an explicit check in the compiler? Is it an extension method? No. And I thought, this is dumb. Why are we doing this extra work for something that's actually quite useful? So now you can use extension methods in your collection initializers. And life is good. We are gaining exception filters. Who here is a Visual Basic person? VB? VB represent? Yeah, VB represent. One person. Okay. All right. Would you like to do the lording it over the C# people dance for one last time? Because your feature is coming to C#. So in Visual Basic, you've been able to do this for a while. So put a condition on an exception filter, on a catch clause, so that it will not just catch by type, but catch by type and some criterion. So in this case, it will only catch the file not found exception if the file name was goodbye.txt. if the error was on the hello.txt, then I don't need to write a separate clause for that. I can just let that propagate, or I can catch that separately or whatever. So it means I can move some of that sort of conditional and rethrow logic out of my catch handlers and into these exception filters. There is a handy use of exception filters, which is wrong. It is wrong, but it is mentioned in the C-sharp spec as, we know everyone's going to do this, so what the hell? And that is to do the world's naughtiest exception logging. You use an exception filter, and you just say, you know, in the filter, you log the exception and then go, whew, no, duh, it didn't meet my criterion after all. Gosh, better go on into the catch block or whatever. So, don't go into the catch block. So that will result in the exception still being propagated, but it being logged along the way. Nice, classy. Constructor type inference. So used to be that you had to, if you were using a generic constructor, you would have to spell out the type parameters explicitly. That was boring, so people used these factory methods. In C# 6, you'll be able to write that, and it will infer that it will infer the generic type parameters like any other method will do. All right. Any questions on that? Okay. I'm going to show you some Visual Basic. I've shown you all the good bits, but there are some even better bits. Something that Visual Basic is likely to gain, again, no one is committing to anything, is being able to switch on types. So you're given an object, and you can go, case it's a string. Well, hey, in that case, I will use it in a strongly typed way as a string. If it's URI, I can use it in a strongly typed way as URI, and so on. And it's also gaining filters on cases. I want to briefly show you something that has been talked about within the C# team and has kind of been posted as a draft externally. It's not part of the main Roslyn compiler. They have built a compiler for it. It's not going to be part of C# 6. It may never be part of C#. There may never be anything ever again. I can't commit to anything. But I would like to show it to you because I think it's kind of cool. And that is a proposal for pattern matching in C#. And if you've used something like F# or Haskell or ML, then you'll recognize the kind of thing that's going on here. The idea is, firstly, we're going to have this notion, or we're not going to. The proposal is, the idea is, that there might be this new kind of class called a record class, which is really a plain old data class, but it defines this interesting new operator called operator is. And that allows it to be used as a sort of matching expression. The idea is that also you'll be able to define these static classes that define operator is. And again, these say, is this coordinates usable as a polar or a within unit circle or whatever? And then you could write code that would look like that. You could use the is operator, not just for testing whether something is a member of a type, but whether it matches a pattern. So if this coordinate is within unit circle, it's going to give me a Boolean. You can also bind out parameters within that. So if it's a polar with some radius, then I'll write out the radius. An interesting thing is that this will also, some existing language constructs like types will also give rise to patterns. So this is similar to that Visual Basic thing that I showed you. Whereas Visual Basic may get it, C# won't. Again, we've got, if O is int I, gives us a strong typed I if it matches. If O is string S, again, we can use S in a strong typed way. We can use this for extracting things from nullable types in a safe manner. And we can even use it in a switch statement. And we can also use the sort of custom design patterns in those switch statements as well. And this means that you can write, say, a symbolic mathematics, then you could define, say, this hierarchy of expressions. So you define an expression class, you define these record classes to implement it. And then if, say, I want to do derivative of an expression, then I just need to go through the various cases. The case where it's a variable, a constant, the addition of two expressions, multiplication of two expressions, or the negation. And I can get strong type versions out in each case and use those, and I can get the actual values out in a strong typed way. If you want to know more about this, then there is a active discussion thread, which is that one there. So just jump onto the Roslyn site, roslyn.codeplex.com, and have a look. And you will see that and many other discussions going on. All right. Any questions on the C# 6 feature set? Okay. I want to briefly show you some examples of the tooling that we can build with Roslyn. So the idea of Roslyn was that it would be a compiler as a service. Rather than being a monolithic black box compiler where code goes in and errors come out, at least that's how it always works for me, it would be something where you could actually, you could call on bits of it to write tools with. So for example, you could call on the syntax analyzer to write refactoring tools or analysis tools. You call on the semantic analysis, so for example, the data flow analysis, to figure out some of the behavior of your program at compile time. And we don't have the time to, and it's kind of too complicated and deep to go into to too much depth, but I just want to briefly show you a couple of the things, or one of the things from the Roslyn samples kit that shows the kind of things that you can do. What I want to show you is the pairing of a diagnostic analyzer and what they call a code fix provider. So a diagnostic analyzer is a Roslyn thing that will put red squigglies under your code. If you haven't got enough red squigglies, this is a great way to get some more. This one is going to put a red squiggly if you declare a variable that could actually be a const, so a local variable that could actually be a local const. So it inherits from this syntax node analyzer. It has this diagnostic analyzer attribute on it, and it implements It implements a method, some method. Anyway, the work is all done in this can-be-made const method, which is given some abstract representation of the code, and you can then kind of search, well, you know, does it already have the const keyword? If it already has the const keyword, I'm not going to put a wiggly on it. Somebody else can put a wiggly on it if you've done it wrong. Not my problem. Then I can look through and say, well, is it actually initialized? Because if it's not being initialized at that point, it can't be a const. If it's being initialized, is it being initialized to a simple thing like a string or a primitive rather than some crazy user-defined conversion sort of madness? And is it modified anywhere else in the method? So if any of those things are the case, then we return false, otherwise we return true, and we can then put up that wiggly. We can also define what they call a code fix provider, which is a thing for getting rid of red wigglies. And this has got these methods, get the fixable diagnostic ideas, that basically says which diagnostic analyzers do I fix the mess that they've found, and get fixes async, which returns a collection of code actions that are basically things that will appear in that light bulb drop down where, you know, it's like the resharper thing where, you know, you press control dot or whatever and it says, I'm going to remove all your usings and I'm going to delete this and move that elsewhere, and your code will be shorter and sweeter, and it will annoy Ivan because he gets annoyed about that sort of thing. And how does this work? Well, basically, we just, I can't walk through the details, but basically it is modifying this syntax tree. So it's being handed a document, a Roslyn document, and it is producing a new document, which it does fundamentally by adding a const modifier to that document in the right place. And you put those two things together and you'll be able to get those red wigglies in Visual Studio, and you'll be able to get things on that drop-down menu. And it's a very simple sample, but if you compare that to the sort of thing you've had to do if you were having to parse all that C-sharp by hand, if you're having to write the Visual Studio integration by hand, there is a whole lot of simplification there. It's going to make life a lot easier for people writing tools. It's going to make it much more feasible for people to write their own tools rather than relying on external vendors such as JetBrains or CodeRush or whatever. Not that there's anything wrong with those, but if you've got something that they don't support, this is possibly a way for you to implement your own coding standards and things like that within Visual Studio. The final thing, I want to talk about the Roslyn delivery model. And this is where I am going to be at my furthest from any kind of official Microsoft line, in case I wasn't far enough already. These are my thoughts, my interests, my speculations. They do not in any way represent my employer or anybody else who works for my employer. So Roslyn, at least the compiler part of it, is open source. The Visual Studio tooling is not open source, but the compiler is. What is more, as I showed you earlier, there is this discussions area where the language team are active. They are no longer doing their design work in private. They are doing it out there on the web. They're having discussions. Obviously, they're meeting amongst themselves, they're coming to conclusions amongst themselves, but they're posting their design notes. They are participating in the threads on this forum. Changes are being made. Features are being altered. The declaration expressions feature was altered just last week as a result of feedback they got. Some of the indexer stuff has been withdrawn because of the feedback they got. They are actively involved in these discussions. They are consulting the community. The community is engaged. But what is more than that, the license for Roslyn is the Apache 2 license. And who here loves open source licensing? Oh, there's one person. Okay. There's someone at the back as well. Everyone thinks that open source licensing is really dreary. And, you know, the 479 of you other than Daniel are correct. It is really dreary. But it is also hugely important, because it controls what you can do with the open source code and what you can't do. And by choosing the Apache 2 license, they have made an explicit decision that you are allowed to create what they call derivative works of Microsoft's open source code. That means that you can take the Roslyn compiler, you can make your own private copy of it, and you can party on it. You can make your own changes to the language. You can even ship those changes to the language. You can create, please don't call it C-sharp if you do, they'll get really annoyed about that. But you can create derivative works. It is explicit, they've chosen this license so that people can go crazy on C-sharp. Question? Oh, sorry. be more. That's how you do a woohoo. And let's see what's happened. So I don't know if you can read this, but that's 140 forks of Roslyn since it was open sourced. 140 people have made copies. Of those, 138 and a half have gone, oh, I don't know what to do next. But the other one and a half are doing interesting things with it. Here, you know, here, number two on this is, you know, this is the second one alphabetical order. Somebody is implementing dimensional context switching. I have no idea what that is, but I love it already. I can run my TARDIS on C sharp now. It's going to be awesome. What else have we got? We've got people creating custom keywords, changing that. So somebody is making fields public by default. Let's not look at that any further. That's not good. Someone is playing with duck typing, which I think is an interesting addition to the thing. Adding generic attributes. There's people who are interested. They're engaged. They're trying to add features to language to serve their needs, or just to learn their way around, or as interesting research extensions, or whatever. It's a language that is available to play with, for you to do your own thing with. You can create those derivative works. And for me, personally, that is the exciting thing about the future of C#. It is not primary constructors, though they are pretty exciting. It is not null propagation, though that is pretty exciting too, in a kind of scary way. It is the fact that C# is now out out from behind the walled garden. The team are engaged. There will still be an official Microsoft C#. It is still being worked on by Microsoft Teams. It is still shipping a Visual Studio. That will be a blessed Microsoft version. But you can create your own versions. You can fix things. You can contribute this. You can offer your changes back to the team. They've made it clear that for any actual functional changes, as opposed to, say, bug fixes or doc changes, then there'll be a very high bar to climb. But you can talk to them. You can offer that stuff. If you've got smaller changes, like fixing documentation or a bug you found, you can fix it. You can offer that back to the team, and they will listen. They are interested. They want to see what people are doing with this. And this kind of puts me, when I heard Nigel Parker talking yesterday in the keynote about being an impossible person, about surmounting barriers, about not being constrained by thinking, I can't do that, I thought about this, because we can all do this stuff now. It's not easy, it's a complicated program, but if you're interested, it's there. There's examples, there's samples, there's other people doing it, there's a community around this. There's the Roslyn team who would be, I'm sure, delighted to engage with people on this. And so the big takeaway for me is that the future of C# is not C# V6 or what the guys in Redmond are doing. The future of C# is in this room. Future of C# is us. Thank you.